Chapter 28. In the dark, with our roosters to crow us on our way, we rolled out of the gate and headed to Hua with the other refugees. All along the road, we kept meeting men we knew, men who had come to dinner or tea with us. They were retreating steadily, and it did all look a bit black. They told us what was ahead of us on the road, where the Germans were, what risks we took, and then left it to our judgment. We were one of them now. I can't tell you, I could never in a lifetime show you how fine people are when all the external, superficial barriers are stripped away by a great emergency. We went back and forth all morning, carrying refugees. It was heartbreaking to see the babies 1 and 2 days old, the sick and the old, and always the soldiers and the guns and the planes. For the rest of the day, Nell directed traffic for the great retreat, and I did my best to match up families. Nell and I stayed on at the crossroads until Dr. Baldwin came to bring us into Montdidier to join the rest, and we discovered Kate was missing. Miss Anne Dawlish, class of 1907, to Miss Ruth Minster. March 1918, Montdidier, France. Emmy had left Will's letters at Greycourt. It was such a stupid thing to be thinking about. There were so many things to be done. There were blankets to be stuffed with straw to make makeshift beds, milk to be warmed for the babies, and tin after tin of sardines to be opened. But as Emmy hurried around the hotel in Montdidier, making sure all of their refugees were fed and had places to sleep for the night, she found herself slowing and thinking of that packet of letters in her trunk in Greycourt with a sharp pang of grief that hit her right in the center of her chest. Emmy paused with her arms full of blankets, hugging them to herself as hard as she could, reminding herself that she needed to be strong for the unit, for all their people who needed them. They'd been finding their own people all day. There were families she knew from Canisy and Courcelle, and it had been a solace to have the children run to her and hug her and know that seeing her there eased their fear a little, that if their Mademoiselle Amy was there, then everything couldn't be all bad. The grown-ups were harder. Some of their questions were relatively simple ones, finding missing baggage, or worse, missing family members. Emmy could say, "Well, the cars are still coming in. We'll see who Alice brings." Or, "Where exactly was it that you left your sack of linge?" It was the other questions that were harder, the big questions, the ones who wanted to know when they could go back again, what the unit would do to replace what had been lost, when they could rebuild again. Would they be back in time to finish the spring planting? "I don't know," she wanted to say. "I don't know, I don't know, I don't know." But part of her job was to give people hope, to make them feel like there was some certainty, some safety in this horrible, mixed-up madhouse of a world into which they had plummeted. So she smiled and said things like, "As soon as we know more, we'll be sure to tell everyone," which meant the same thing, really, but sounded so much better, because it made it sound like the unit had some control over the situation when they hadn't really, not at all. All they had was this hotel, for which they were paying a rather alarming amount, and one duffel each. And Alice didn't even have that, because her duffel had got lost in the transfer from Hua to Montdidier, goodness only knew where or how, so she would have to borrow clothes from Emmy and Anne, because she was too tall for Kate's or Florence's or Nell's, and Julia hadn't bothered to bring much in the way of personal possessions, instead cramming her bag with all the medical supplies they could manage. Alice, of course, was pretending this was all very well, but Emmy knew she minded horribly, that her frills were her armor, and she was as cut up about it as Emmy was about leaving Will's letters. Will, somewhere on the front lines. It didn't mean he was lost. People survived. They did. She'd seen it. She'd seen them survive in all sorts of ways, some almost worse than not surviving at all. Emmy pushed back that horrible thought, hating herself for it. Nothing could be worse than Will not surviving. She tried not to think of the men in the American hospital at Neuilly, having their faces rebuilt like a child's exercise in clay. No one knew anything. No one could tell them anything. She'd stopped asking because it was all the same from everyone she'd asked. There'd been fog, and the Germans had come out of nowhere, overwhelming them, and no one knew where his own messmates were, let alone another regiment. Only that the Germans were pushing on and on and on. They'd heard conflicting accounts throughout the day. The Germans were bombing Paris. The Germans had been stopped at Cambrai. The English were all fleeing. The English were making a stand. Only one thing was solid and true. There were people here, living, breathing, lonely, scared people who needed help, who had been pushed from their homes and separated from their families. Emmy rolled up her sleeves and scrounged stoves and badgered the Red Cross for supplies and tried not to think too much of what was happening a dozen miles away, what Kate and Florence and Anne and Nell were driving back into again and again and again. Or Will, out there at the front, riding up out of the mist to warn them and then riding away again, gone. Useless to remind herself there were other women's sweethearts out there, too. It was hard not to be selfish when you'd found the one person in the world whose mind marched with yours, who made you feel in all ways better than you could ever possibly be. The blankets? Someone was saying. It was one of their Quaker friends from Om who had worked so hard at rebuilding the roofs that the Germans were at the present engaged in tearing back down. They'd shown up at the hotel earlier in the day, offering their services in getting the refugee center up and running, and had been working like troopers ever since. Whenever she looked at them, Emmy saw in their eyes something she was desperately afraid of seeing in her own, a bewildered sort of grief, confused and desolate all at once. Emmy blinked rapidly and handed over the bundle.
"Sorry, I have them here. Is everyone tucked up?"
"Almost. Madame Lenoir's two-year-old is rampaging all over the place, pretending to be an elephant. We may have to tie him to his cot."
The young man hesitated and then said, "Would you like to go take a rest? We can hold the fort for you for a bit." Alice had staked out two rooms for the unit, insisting that they needed to sleep if they were to help anyone. The idea of going upstairs, of pulling the covers over her head, was tempting beyond belief. Every muscle in her body felt sore with tension. This morning, she'd had enough energy for 15 people, but it was beginning to wear off, leaving exhaustion and achiness and a horrible, howling sort of emptiness. She had to keep moving. She had to keep working, or the emptiness would grab her and pull her in. If she let herself close her eyes in the darkness, she would have to acknowledge everything that had happened, that they had lost Grey Corps, had lost everything they'd worked and worked and worked for, that their people were homeless again. That Will was missing, likely dead.
"No, that's all right," said Emmy brightly. "You go on. Kate and Anne and Nell are still out there, and I don't want to go to bed until they get back."
Kate had come back for 5 minutes and then gone off again. 1 minute she had been there, and the next the jitney was gone, presumably back to Nell and Anne. Florence, coming back dusty but cheerful as ever, had said that Nell was directing traffic, and Anne was at the crossroads, reuniting families. Neither of them drove, so Kate must have gone back for them. Emmy reached for the watch at her breast before remembering it was lost, lost since yesterday, which felt more like 10 years ago. Madame Lenoir came to ask her for warm milk to settle her son, who was driving everyone mad with his elephant impression. Nell had taught him that and was entirely unrepentant about it. Emmy went to dilute and warm the milk, glancing at the clock in the kitchen. Nearly 10. Surely they should be back by now. Alice and Florence had already gone to bed, leaving the white and the Ford parked outside. A truck rumbled to a stop outside. There were voices, American voices, thank goodness. Emmy popped the door open, but it wasn't the jitney outside. It was a Red Cross truck, with Dr. Baldwin at the wheel and Anne and Nell saying their goodbyes. Emmy looked behind them for Kate, but there was no sign of her.
"Hello," she said to Dr. Baldwin. "Did the jitney break down? Where's Kate?"
"Isn't she with you?" asked Anne, rubbing her gritty eyes with the back of her hand. Her hair was straggling out from under her hat. She looked thoroughly done in.
She came back here hours ago.
No, said Emmy slowly. She came here and then she left again. I thought she went back to you.
Maybe she went straight to bed.
Nell staggered as she stepped down from the truck.
My legs feel like they're about to give out. I never knew it was such hard work directing traffic.
Alice saved two rooms for us upstairs if you want to go up. Maybe Nell was right. Maybe Kate had gone upstairs. There had been confusion with a woman whose husband had been hit by a cart during the retreat, who insisted on bringing in the body to be resuscitated, even though he was clearly well past saving, and that had occupied Emmy's attention for some time, trying to gently get the woman away from the body and find a friend to sit with her. Dr. Baldwin was asking about his patients.
Oh, yes, this way. Julia's set up a room as a children's hospital. We've added quite a few to your original patients, I'm afraid. Julia and Mrs. Goodale have been working tirelessly.
Pausing, Emmy looked back at Nell, feeling silly but worried all the same.
Would you mind seeing if Kate's upstairs? I'm sure she is, but...
It wasn't like Kate to just go to bed when there was work to be done. But even Kate was human, and ferrying refugees was a bone-wearying test of endurance, emotionally and physically trying. It would, however, thought Emmy, cheering up a bit, be very like Kate to just sit down for a moment and be so tired her body gave out on her. She was probably asleep in her clothes right now, still thinking it was 4 hours ago, and she'd just nodded off for a moment.
We have 22 children here at present.
Emmy said, taking Dr. Baldwin into the infirmary.
There were three cases from Saint-Cour that looked like measles, so we've put those children into a separate room, and Marie, our mayor from Graycour, is sitting with them.
Marie and Madame Gouge, the cook/housekeeper Mrs. Barrett had hired, had been in competition to show who could do more for the unit. In the end, they'd had to separate them, leaving Madame Gouge in command of the kitchen and Marie in charge of the infectious diseases, which had the added benefit, as Julia had acidly pointed out, of getting them both out of her infirmary so she could actually care for her patients without having spoons of broth being thrust under her nose every 3 seconds. Julia was kneeling next to a pallet, listening to a boy's chest. At Dr. Baldwin's entrance, she pushed herself stiffly to her feet and began briefing him. Nell popped her head in, saying in a stage whisper,
Kate's not upstairs.
Julia turned sharply, pausing mid-sentence.
What's that about Kate?
She went back to Rouen and doesn't seem to have come back.
Emmy tried to sound casual about it, but she couldn't.
Could she still be there? She might be looking for Anne and Nell. It's like something out of a French farce, isn't it? Everyone looking for everyone else and going in circles.
It's nearly 11 already, said Julia. She would come back here if she couldn't find them. Emmy tried not to sound as panicked as she felt.
Maybe we should go back for her.
No one's going back. Army's orders. If she's still there, she's probably bunked down at the hospital for the night, said Dr. Baldwin dismissively as he moved toward the basin to wash his hands. I wouldn't worry.
No, of course,
lied Emmy.
If you'll excuse me.
Julia followed her out.
Where are you going? She asked bluntly.
Emmy hesitated, knowing Julia would mock her, but she needed to confide in someone, and there was no one else.
Kate would never just leave Anne and Nell. What if she went to the crossroads to look for them and the jitney broke down? It was making strange noises this morning. Kate said she'd have Alice look at it, but I don't know if she did. We were all so busy.
Julia didn't mock her. She said,
Who can we get to drive?
I can drive, said Emmy, heading out the door. Alice taught me. Wait, what are you doing?
Julia had climbed up into the white. She sat there, ramrod straight, her medical bag in her lap.
Coming with you.
But they need you here.
Dr. Baldwin is back.
Julia shrugged and then said with deliberate provocation,
You need me more than he does. You've never been able to read a map. You got lost once in the garden of your own house.
It was a maze,
Emmy protested, knowing she should make Julia stay, but selfishly relieved not to be going alone. The street was so dark, with no streetlights and all the windows blacked out. She would have to somehow navigate in the dark without headlights.
It was designed for people to get lost in.
A gun boomed somewhere miles away, and Emmy felt the car swerve as she flinched. They'd been under fire so much, but it felt different being out at night, in the dark, at the wheel. The walls of the house weren't much protection, but they were something. Emmy took a deep breath.
You shouldn't talk. You were the one who led me into the maze and left me.
Julia balanced her medical bag on her knees. I told you all you had to do was keep going left.
Yes, but you know I can't tell my right from my left.
There was an army camion coming straight her way, also without headlights. Emmy clung to the wheel, wrenching the white out of the way just in time, narrowly evading a collision with an ambulance. The road was busy with traffic, complicated by everyone having their lights off. All she could see were shapes in the dark.
You never told on me, said Julia unexpectedly, as Emmy wrestled the truck back onto the road.
About leaving you in the maze. Why?
It was easier to let Nanny scold me for being silly than to have her punish you.
Nanny wouldn't have punished the Van Alden children, but an unpleasant child who was dropped into her care without a by-your leave was another matter entirely. Julia had been sentenced to cold baths, locked in dark rooms, and when none of that had any effect, treated to the horrifying slap of birch against flesh.
It wasn't hard. Nanny expected me to be silly.
Not far away, a plane plummeted from the sky, flames billowing from its tail. The light momentarily lit the scene, the road, the trucks, the scrap of metal falling like Icarus. A cart horse neighed in panic, nearly oversetting the cart it was pulling.
If I get through this,
Emmy said, her teeth chattering so hard she could barely get the words out.
Fifth Avenue won't have any terrors for me.
Julia looked at her hard, but didn't make fun. There's the crossroads. There's a sentry on guard. I'll ask him if he's seen the jitney. Stay here. Emmy stayed, using the time to try to get her breathing under control. She could see Julia, a dim figure in her gray uniform, having a long conversation with the sentry, interrupted from time to time as the sentry paused to direct traffic or stop a truck. Emmy's fingers were tingling with pins and needles. It seemed so silly to worry about pins and needles when the guns were rumbling and she could see the lights flashing in the sky that meant air battles. And where, oh, where was Kate?
She's not here, said Julia, hauling herself back into the white. She went through here 4 hours ago, headed east.
East?
East was the front. East was the guns and the shells and explosions of gas that turned the air to poison.
East, repeated Julia grimly. She said something about going to Moincor after a lost child and a goat.
A lost child and a goat.
Zaylee? It has to be Zaylee. But they all arrived.
Emmy tried desperately to remember who she'd seen at the refugee center. She could picture Marie's son, Yves, the 9-year-old girl who helped milk the cows, and Madame Lenoir's toddler, of course. But not Zaylee. She stared at Julia, feeling a growing sense of horror.
Oh no.
Moincor, 3 miles from Greycor. It was where Florence had sent their animals, including the goats. What had Kate told her yesterday? Zaylee had been devastated. She was only 5, a 5-year-old with no family, with nothing but that goat.
Oh no,
Emmy said again, feeling the guilt all the way down in her bones.
I never realized. I just assumed she was with the others. But Kate...
It's been 4 hours, said Julia remorselessly. Even on these roads, it shouldn't have taken more than an hour each way.
If something happened to her, we need to find her.
Emmy started the white, praying the engine would catch. We don't know how far the Germans have come. The night was terrible, with the sound of battles being fought to the east, the crack of rifle fire, the rumbles of explosions, the sound of booted feet marching, the whine of airplanes overhead as the Germans tried to bomb the railways and the roads, and their boys, American and British and French and Canadian, took to the skies to stop them. The Germans could be anywhere, crossing the canals at Kenizy, fighting hand to hand in the woods near Alfoy, creeping through the fog toward Moincor. It was madness to go forward into goodness only knew what.
We can't leave her,
Emmy said stubbornly. If you want to wait for me here, you can, but I'm going.
Julia leaned back with something of her old air of insouciance.
Late on, Macduff.
It's lay on, said Emmy, her breath catching on a sob.
I don't think it matters, said Julia, picking up a gas mask and setting it down next to Emmy. Do you?
The sentry wasn't pleased with them.
What are you doing?
He demanded as Emmy accelerated past, as fast as the white would go, dust rising in her wake.
Miss! Miss! You don't want to go that way!
Emmy ignored him, bumping the car down the rutted road, trying to remember the way to Moyncourt.
Left, said Julia. Your other left, we need to go north.
Emmy wrenched the truck left, trying to keep her eyes on the road and search the verge at the same time.
When she left, I never thought. I was so busy. There were so many people to feed.
Spilled milk, said Julia succinctly. Think, which way would she have gone?
Emmy took a deep breath.
The road to Erschu.
There were side roads, cart tracks, really, but Kate was more likely to have stuck with the road she knew. She'd been back and forth on the road to Erschu for a good part of the day. They had come down this same road only this morning, on the way from Greycourt. In the last 18 hours, the landscape had grown infinitely more desolate, with wheelbarrows and luggage abandoned by the side of the road and a downed German plane smoldering in a field. Emmy could smell burning metal and acrid smoke. There were signs of accidents everywhere, twisted bicycles and burned-out trucks. Emmy thought of the woman whose husband had been run over by a cart and wondered if Kate was lying somewhere, broken and lifeless. She hunched over the wheel, drawing as far to the side as she dared to avoid an army camion.
It's my fault Kate's here. I made her come.
Huh, said Julia roughly. Have you ever seen anyone make Kate do anything?
The driver of the camion braked, leaning out the window.
It's the Smith unit, isn't it? There's no one here to collect. Go back, it's not safe anymore.
We're looking for one of our own.
Emmy wished her voice sounded less wobbly.
Have you seen a Ford jitney?
There was a brief consultation. The head reemerged.
There was a truck abandoned by the road at the crossroads just east of Erschu. It might have been a Ford.
Emmy appreciated that he didn't try to stop them, just gave them a quick précis of everything he knew of current troop movements, which wasn't much.
It might not be the jitney, Julia warned her as they rattled on, past Erschu, which didn't look at all like the village it had been only 2 days ago, empty now, echoing in its emptiness.
But there, at the crossroads just outside Erschu, on the road that branched one way to Esmerie-Allon and the other to Moyncourt, Emmy saw the familiar outlines of a Ford jitney, with the dent in the side where Liza had hit the gate back in October. Emmy braked hard, hard enough to make them both jolt forward, and was out of the white and running before she even knew what she was doing, shining her flashlight at the jitney, calling, Kate! Kate!
No one answered. Chapter 29.
Wednesday in Mr. Hunt's office, I met with half a dozen delegates from the devastated regions, all of whom wanted the Smith unit in their own districts, as the Red Cross considers our work at Greycourt nearly done. Each man thought he had just the place for us in his territory. Thursday, Williams, White, McCoy, and McMorris finally secured their passes to Greycourt. Liza Shaw, who had previously been with the unit, asked if she might rejoin, and as her pass was still good, we cheerfully welcomed her back. Friday morning's paper told us of heavy bombardments, but upon inquiry, Mr. Hunt told us he didn't think it ought to impede our getting back. Just as our train pulled out of the Gare du Nord at 8 a.m. on Saturday, we heard two heavy explosions, and while, at this time, there is still some uncertainty as to their origin, they are thought to have come from a massive gun 75 miles away. At the station in Noyon, we were met by Mr. Barbie, the man who got our new house for us, and the first thing he said was, Greycourt has been evacuated. Just then, a shell burst near us. I don't know which alarmed me more. We have been trying to get word of the rest of the unit. A young doctor of the AEF told us he had heard they had been doing wonderful work, evacuating civilians through Wa.
He kept telling us he was sure they would be all right, until I was quite ready to tell him that I thought we knew more of them than he did. I do hope they are all right.
Mrs. James R. Barrett, née Ruth Irwin, class of 1902, director to the Paris Committee. March 1918. Montdidier, France. Zélie whimpered in Kate's lap. Kate felt like whimpering too, but that wouldn't be the responsible thing to do. Not that anyone was watching her, here on the outskirts of what had once been a village, protected only by the dubious shelter of an overturned farm cart. It was better than nothing, she supposed, trying to tuck the blanket from the truck closer around Zélie without moving the girl's leg, which, even to Kate's inexperienced eyes, looked very bad indeed. She'd found Zélie fallen in a shell hole, looking like so much crumpled laundry not far from Moyencourt. It had been hellish getting her out, and even worse getting her back to the truck, with Zélie clinging to her neck in such pain with every movement. Kate had wrapped the leg as best she could, she was afraid to even touch the bit of bone sticking out, and tried to drive as gently as she could on the rutted road, but they'd made it only as far as Erchu when the jitney gave out entirely. Which would never have happened if she'd done what she ought to have done and taken it to Alice to look at. Kate sat with Zélie on her lap, doing her best not to move or cry. She'd been unpardonably thoughtless. Blame it on lack of sleep, blame it on the confusion of the retreat, blame it on whatever one liked, she ought to have known better. Kate looked down at the child in her lap. She looked so small, so fragile. They all joked about how bossy Zélie was, but sleeping, her face was rounder and softer. Kate was forcibly reminded of just how young she still was, just one step away from babyhood. But what a babyhood. Zélie's entire life, her entire life as she remembered it, had been lived under the shadow of war, one long litany of loss. No wonder she had gone back into a war zone after a goat. The goat was all she had. She ought to have known better. She ought to have known that Zélie would do something like this. They'd made a joke of Zélie following her around. Kate had been touched and flattered by the little girl's affection. But when it came down to it, she had failed Zélie. She could tell herself that it had been the right thing to do, sending Zélie off with the rest of the Basse-Cour, and it had. But she might have taken the extra time to explain to Zélie what was happening, to ask Marie or Madame Lenoir to take special care of her, or to find a way for them to take the blasted goat. Instead, she'd just waved them all off and told herself her duty to them was done. And now, here they were. With a broken truck, in the dark. Troops moving all around, German planes overhead, explosions coming from the east. She could try to carry Zélie, but she didn't think they would get far that way. Even if she weren't so worried about jarring Zélie's leg, Kate wasn't sure she could carry her. How far was it back to Montdidier? 15 miles? 20? Too far. Even a mile would be too far. Kate smoothed the little girl's hair back from her brow and tried to think. In the morning, when it was light, it should be easy enough to get help. They could flag down a dispatch carrier, send word to the unit. But who knew what the morning would bring? The Germans might be moving already, now, under cover of darkness. She'd heard explosions before and thought, hoped, that it might be their British friends blowing up the bridges across the Somme, but there was no guarantee that would hold the Germans for long. Who would get to them first, their friends or the Germans?
Kate?
Kate shivered with cold and misery. She must have been drifting off to sleep, dreaming. She'd thought she'd heard Emmy calling her name.
Kate!
There it was again, and it really did sound like Emmy, unless it was the auditory equivalent of a mirage, panic creating false sounds, or just ears gone tinny with the constant booming of the guns. Gently as she could, Kate wiggled out from under Zélie, who winced and muttered, her sleeping face creased with pain. Kate's right leg had gone completely numb. She had to drag it along, trying to flex her toes to drive the blood back into it. Light arced through the night, half blinding Kate. She heard the sound of a scuffle, and then Julia's voice saying in a harsh whisper,
"Turn that thing off! What do you want to do, send an engraved invitation to the Bosch?"
A wave of sheer joy flooded Kate. She might hallucinate many things, but not Julia telling Emmy off.
"Emmy? Julia?"
Kate staggered around the cart, so giddy with relief she hardly felt the pins and needles in her right leg.
"Kate!"
Emmy grabbed her, hugging her so enthusiastically she couldn't breathe.
"You can't imagine how worried we've been. What happened? The sentry said something about a girl and a goat."
"I came to find Zaylee," Kate said at the same time, both of them speaking over each other.
"And I've got her, but the jitney broke down, and Zaylee's leg is broken, and thank heavens, I've never been so glad to see anyone in my life."
Julia cleared her throat. "This reunion is very touching, but may I suggest we remove ourselves to an area a little farther away from the battlefield?" Kate wiped her eyes with the back of her hand, giving a laugh that wanted to be a sob.
"I'm glad to see you too, Julia. I've left Zaylee behind that cart. She's sleeping. She's got a broken leg. I had thought I could carry her to a road where we could get a lift with an army truck, but it was hurting her too much, so I thought we'd find some place to wait until morning."
Julia borrowed Emmy's flashlight to twitch back the blanket and look at Zaylee's leg.
"You're an excellent administrator, but you make a lousy nurse. I'm going to need to reset that.
How bad is it?"
"Bad."
"Trust Julia not to sugarcoat it," thought Kate.
"Let's get her into the truck. The sooner we get you both out of here, the better."
They all froze as everything around them shook, lights dotting the sky from miles away. It was like all the 4th of July fireworks all together, sparks setting off sparks, setting off sparks, a crazy funnel of electricity lighting the sky. Kate stared, half blinded.
"What was that?"
"They've been blowing up bridges," offered Emmy.
"That wasn't a bridge," said Julia.
There was a choked, whimpering sound from their feet. The noise had startled Zaylee awake, jarring her injured leg. Any other 5-year-old would have howled. Instead, she had crammed her hand into her mouth, trying so very hard not to be heard. It cut Kate clear through to the heart, listening to her try to choke back her pain so the Bosch wouldn't get them.
"We're getting you out of here,"
Kate said contritely, kneeling by the little girl.
"Do you remember Dr. Prine? She's going to fix your leg for you. And then we're going to scold you like you've never been scolded before for scaring us like that."
"I need it, Minerva,"
Zaylee rasped, her eyes wide with fear and pain.
"You'll just have to make do with us," said Kate, trying to smile. "I know we're not as good as a goat, but we'll try."
"Oh dear, please don't cry."
"Of course she's crying, she has a compound fracture," said Julia impatiently.
Next to her, Julia had been having a whispered consultation with Emmy. They arranged themselves on either side of Zaylee, the flashlight lying on its side on the ground so that it shone directly on the girl's leg. Next to Julia were two broken boards from the cart.
"Hold her hand," Julia said tersely to Kate.
Kate had never felt so helpless, clinging to Zaylee's hand, burying the little girl's head in the folds of her skirt as Julia did something truly horrible to her leg. Zaylee gave a muffled cry and then went limp, her forehead cold and clammy.
"Julia?"
whispered Kate.
"Hush,"
said Julia, fitting the two boards around the girl's leg and wrapping the blanket around and around.
"Not what she needs, but it will have to do. They didn't teach us field dressing at Johns Hopkins."
"What? She's fainted, that's all. You can lift her now. Emmy, brace her legs. 1, 2.
They got Zaylee into the white truck, Julia putting Zaylee's head on her lap and improvising a makeshift cradle for her legs, as Emmy squeezed Kate's hand and said,
"Don't worry, it's all right now."
Before, improbably, going over to turn the crank and start the car, as if starting a car were something she did all the time. Kate climbed up onto the bench seat, shivering with cold and reaction.
"Thank you," she said belatedly. "Thank you for coming to get me."
"Thank Emmy," said Julia from the back. "Dr. Baldwin was all for leaving you."
"Don't be silly. We couldn't leave you."
Emmy, with a look of great concentration, was backing up, making her way as carefully as she could around the broken jitney.
Kate's hands felt like they belonged to someone else. She flexed them just to see if she could.
I've been impossibly stupid. You can tell me what a fool I was if you like.
It wasn't just you. I should have realized she was missing, said Emmy apologetically. If I hadn't been distracted.
Somehow, Emmy apologizing just made it even worse. It was just like Emmy, taking the blame when it was Kate's fault, when it was all Kate's fault. And Kate had let her. For months and months, she had made herself feel important at Emmy's expense. But not anymore.
It wasn't your fault. It was mine.
Kate dug her nails into her palms, welcoming the pain.
I was the one who said we shouldn't go off alone. I'm the one who said we should never get attached. I'm the one who should have known better.
Emmy looked at her in surprise.
But of course you had to go. You couldn't have left her there any more than we could have left you.
Kate couldn't help herself. A little whimpering noise came out, and then another. She clamped her hands over her face, trying to hold the sobs in, but they forced themselves through anyway. All the tears she hadn't let herself cry before, ugly, gasping, panting tears ripping through her, tearing her insides out. Of course, Emmy said. Of course. As if it were obvious. It would never occur to Emmy that Zaylee was just a French orphan, or that Kate might have gotten them all killed, or that, as their acting director, Kate had responsibilities to the unit that ought to have kept her from herring off on a whim. And Kate didn't know if that was wonderful or awful, but she did know that her heart was a shriveled, stunted thing compared to her friends, because she would have thought those things. She had thought those things.
It's all right now, Emmy was saying, as though Kate were Zaylee, as though she were five and could be comforted with a pat on the arm.
Why are you being so kind?
Kate shook her head blindly, her face contorting.
I've been dreadful to you. I've been a rotten friend.
The truck slowed as Emmy waited for a row of gun carriages to pass, trundling along to the front.
What are you talking about? You know I would never have gotten through.
Kate gave a hiccuping laugh.
Smith without me?
Well, yes, that too, but what I meant was all this.
Emmy waved at the guns.
I know I was selfish to ask you to come, but you've been a rock for all of us.
Kate didn't feel like a rock. She felt more like sand, shifting and shiftless.
It's the other way around. It's always been the other way around. I would never have gotten through any of this without you. I would never have gotten through Smith without you. I probably would have been back in Brooklyn within 6 months.
She'd never admitted it to herself before, but it was true. She'd been so scared and lonely.
Do you have any idea how afraid I was of you all? You all spoke right and dressed right, and there I was, embarrassing myself with every vowel and terrified of anyone finding out I didn't belong.
But of course you belonged. You passed the entrance exams. That's more than I can say. They had to make an exception for me.
Kate pressed her lips tightly together to try to stop them from wobbling.
If it hadn't been for you, I wouldn't have done a thing at Smith other than study. I would never have joined a literary society or the dramatic society. I would never have thought I could. All those picnics and ice cream socials, I would never have been invited on my own. But because you took me up, other people did too. That was all your doing. All the best things were your doing. And you never once took any credit.
The camions had gone. Emmy slowly eased the truck back on the road.
Because there wasn't any credit to take. You were secretary of the Literary Society, Kate. You were voted in fair and square.
Because you told me to run for it. Do you think I would have myself? Everything I had, everything I was, came from you.
All the walls Kate had built so carefully were toppling, one after the other, leaving her as much a ruin as Graycore, jagged on the outside and empty within.
I didn't stop writing because I thought you were a burden. I stopped writing because I was afraid people would think I was hanging on your coattails. I was afraid you would think I was hanging on your coattails.
Emmy was squinting at the road, scanning it for potholes.
I always thought I was hanging on your coattails and that you just couldn't stand it anymore.
I never minded helping you. I liked being useful.
And you always made everything so fun.
It sounded so trivial put like that, but it wasn't. There had been such joy in the world in their Smith days, and so much of that joy had come from Emmy, from her ability to laugh at herself, to make anything a joke. Afterward, in Boston, Kate had felt like half the light had gone out of the sky. Everything was grim and gray and serious. Even amusement had felt like work.
I missed you so much. It was so lonely without you.
Emmy gave an audible sniff.
I missed you too. But I didn't want to be a bother, so I thought when you didn't write back.
You had your debutante year and all those parties and your work.
You had your work, and I was sure you were making all sorts of friends who were so much better than I am.
Kate twisted on the seat, feeling the tears making tracks down her dusty cheeks, but not bothering to wipe them away.
There couldn't be a better friend.
Don't be foolish.
Emmy was crying too, swiping at her eyes with the back of her hand, the truck wobbling unevenly across the road, causing a dispatch rider to shout something very uncomplimentary at them.
If I might interrupt your effusions for a moment.
Julia's voice rose from the back of the truck.
This is all very lovely, but please try not to crash the truck. I can set other people's bones, but I don't want to try it on my own.
I don't want you to try it on me either,
said Kate, drawing in a long, shuddering breath and trying to wipe her face with a corner of her sleeve. She looked sheepishly at Emmy.
I guess thinking you're about to die makes you realize what's important.
Not crashing the truck, said Julia firmly, holding on to Zaylee to keep the movement of the truck from jarring her leg. Not crashing the truck is important. You can indulge in all the sentimental rubbish you like once we're safely to the hotel.
It's not rubbish, said Emmy indignantly. Look, there's the crossroads. We're through the worst of it now.
Yes, agreed Kate, looking at Emmy. Emmy, confidently driving the truck, and Julia cradling a 5-year-old French girl. Everything was going mad around them, and they had no idea where the Germans were or what the morning would bring. But they were all together, and that was enough.
I think we are.
Kate was awakened the next morning by someone nudging her arm, hard. Rubbing sleep out of her eyes, Kate blinked up to see Marie Rose, one of their most faithful milk customers, standing over her, poking Kate's prone form with her foot, her baby held in one arm, while her toddler peeped out at Kate from behind Marie Rose's skirt.
I have come for my milk,
Marie Rose said.
Your milk,
said Kate groggily, pulling herself up to a sitting position. She didn't remember falling asleep, but she must have. She remembered getting to the hotel just after midnight and finding it locked, and Julia banging on the door until Nurse Goodale came and opened it. She remembered Dr. Baldwin and Julia rushing off with Zaylee and holding Zaylee's hand while they did something deeply awful to her leg and wrapped it with proper splints and bandages and gave her something to make her sleep, while Kate knelt next to her on the floor holding her hand. She must have fallen asleep that way, because here she was, still in her dust-coated uniform, on the floor of the parlor of the hotel. Zaylee, her leg propped on cushions, was asleep next to her.
Yes, my milk,
said Marie Rose, as if it were the most natural thing in the world that the Smith unit would go on with the business of supplying her baby. It didn't seem to matter to Marie Rose that they weren't at Graycourt anymore. They were the Smith unit, and they were here, and that was what they did. There was something strangely reassuring about that. Kate hauled herself to her feet, wincing at bruises she hadn't remembered she had.
I'll just go find that for you, she said.
Emmy was already up, opening tins of condensed milk, diluting them, and warming them to feed all the children in their care.
Marie Rose is here for her milk, said Kate.
And the next thing she knew, they were both giggling helplessly, like undergraduates again.
I'd best bring it to her, or she'll wake the whole house, said Emmy, expertly decanting warm milk into a bottle. Dr. Devine of the Red Cross Refugee Bureau came by and wanted to know if someone could go help at the station.
He says it's an absolute scrum over there, worse than the New Haven line on Yale-Harvard weekend, and they need someone to sort people out and get them on trains. Oh, and someone from the French mission sent a note, asking if we could spare someone to evacuate Monyi.
Emmy stayed on at the hotel, running the refugee center with help from Madame Gouja, who declared herself in charge of the kitchen, washing dishes and sterilizing bottles and scolding them about having something to eat. Marie, deeply chastened, promised to watch Zélie. Not that Zélie could possibly go anywhere now, with one leg entirely immobilized, but Kate appreciated the sentiment. Under the guidance of the French mission, Florence and Alice went off with the trucks to evacuate any villagers who couldn't walk on their own, while Kate, Anne, and Nell went down to the station, which was just as much of a scrum as Dr. Devine had claimed, with people milling everywhere, looking for lost relations and lost luggage, yanking hungry, hollow-eyed children, elderly people sitting on their bags on street corners, looking lost and hopeless, frantic mothers searching for children who had become separated in the retreat. Kate begged a stove and supplies from the Red Cross, and Anne started running a canteen at the station, with soup for the adults and milk for the children. Nell worked the platform, helping people onto trains, finding lost baggage and lost children, and generally cheering everyone up, while Kate found herself acting as a sort of general information bureau, taking notes on people who had been left behind and families that had been separated, directing the confused people wandering into the town toward the train station and telling them to stop by the canteen for something to eat. It was relentless, heartbreaking work. Some of them had been days walking on foot from villages all the way past Om. When Kate would ask where they were going, the answer was always the same. Je ne sais pas. I don't know. They looked so lost, clinging to their little bits of baggage, torn from their homes for a second or even third time, with no idea where they were going or when they would be back. But a strange thing happened. Some of their villagers started working alongside them. The blacksmith and his wife from Ambleu took over the task of feeding the refugees being herded onto trains, running up and down the platform, handing food through the windows. Madame Chevrier, the seamstress from Bacquancourt, became a one-woman lost luggage bureau, hunting up misplaced baggage. The farrier from Canisy told stories to the children to keep them entertained, and when Kate directed old Madame Didier from Verlaine to the station, the woman pressed 5 francs into Kate's hand.
"To buy milk for the babies," she said imperiously when Kate tried to give it back.
Alice and Florence would swoop in, drop off a load of people, check with Kate for directions, and drive off again, bringing with them news of the outside world, of troops on the move, of villages filled with soldiers preparing for one last stand. Alice came back all excited because a group of French gunners had taken her to their emplacements to see their guns in action, which had been deafening but thrilling. Florence was indignant about the animals she found abandoned en route. Sunday bled into Monday. Monday spilled into Tuesday, feeding and sorting and getting people onto trains, opening tin after tin of milk, slicing loaf after loaf of war bread. The camions rumbled past, endless rows of them, and the cannonading grew louder and closer, but their work had taken on a kind of rhythm, everyone doing their best. So it came as a dreadful shock when the unit stumbled into breakfast Tuesday morning to find a delegation composed of a British major and 2 Red Cross officials with orders that they were to evacuate at once.
"At once?" echoed Emmy. She looked to Kate for support. "But we couldn't possibly, not right away. We have a house full of people who can't be moved, most of them children."
They'd gotten most of their able-bodied refugees onto trains, but the hotel was crammed with the sick and the wounded, ranging in age from a 2-day-old baby to a 97-year-old grandmother. And Zélie, thought Kate, with a sick feeling in her stomach. Zélie, with her badly fractured leg.
"And there's my livestock," protested Florence. "All of our cows and goats. I'll need to see them moved."
"And the station canteen," began Anne. Mr. Jackson, the unit's Red Cross delegate, looked hunted.
You can have until the afternoon, and then you really must go.
Right. We can set up again, said Kate, rallying her troops. We'll simply move on and keep going, just like we did when we left Greycor.
About that, said Mr. Jackson.
Where are you sending us?
We don't know, but you can't just keep on. It's not safe.
But...
Nell looked from one man to the other, furious.
We're doing absolutely useful work. We could keep on doing the same. Just move us a few miles west and we can go on getting people out. We can keep doing what we're doing.
No, I'm afraid you can't, said the Major calmly but firmly. Fritz is moving much faster than anyone expected.
That was the British Army speaking. It was no use, Kate knew.
Then we'd better do as much as we can with the time left to us, said Kate.
I'll get breakfast for everyone and tell them they're going to be moved, said Emmy bravely.
The morning was a disaster. Florence stormed in, fuming because someone had filled her gasoline can with water and she'd poured it into the truck without noticing, and now the truck wouldn't start and the whole engine had to be overhauled. Anne scalded herself, heating milk, and had to be tended to by Julia, whose bedside manner was even more acerbic than usual, a sure sign that she was worried. Kate, meanwhile, had the job of getting all their patients into Red Cross trucks, seeing them settled on mattresses on the beds of the trucks, trying to think what to tell them when they asked again and again where they were going. Zaylee clung to Kate's neck, refusing to go. Kate was half frantic with knowing there were a million things to be done and not wanting Zaylee to hurt her leg. Marie had promised faithfully to stay with Zaylee wherever they were sent, and Kate had to be content with that, because there was no other way.
Please, she begged the little girl. It will just be for a little while. We all have to go. I'll find you once this is all done, I promise.
Why can't you go with me? You promised you'd stay with me.
Her face crumpled, a five-year-old driven beyond endurance.
I want Minerva!
That, at least, Kate knew something about. Florence had gone to see the cows and goats rerouted to Clermont on the grounds that they would need them when they went back to Greycor. When, not if. Kate wasn't sure she believed it, but she had to try, for everyone's sake.
Minerva is being sent to someplace safe.
Kate tried to pry Zaylee's arms from around her neck as the Red Cross driver waved frantically at her, anxious to be off.
You can see her again once the Boche have gone. Once the Boche have gone, we'll all be together again. We'll all go back to Greycor and be together again.
But Zaylee wasn't consoled, and neither was she.
I don't even know where we're going, said Kate with despair as the last wagon rattled away.
The hotel felt eerily empty with the canteen packed up and all their patients gone. Their duffels sat in a pathetic pile in the courtyard, ready to be loaded into the white truck.
How can I tell her?
Amiens, said Emmy, wiping her hands on her apron. Dr. Devine just sent word that we're to go to Amiens.
Oh, that's not so very bad.
Kate looked at Emmy with new hope.
If they let us stay that close, then maybe things aren't as bad as they made it sound.
It wasn't as bad. It was worse. They'd just made it to a hotel in Amiens and begun eating supper when there was a tremendous crash and all the lights went out.
I think we're being bombed, said Alice in a small voice.
Another terrific crash shook the building. Kate found herself part of the general rush to the cellar, which was very small and very crowded. She sat in the dark with Emmy on one side and Julia on the other as the bombs fell continuously all night.
It feels like the whole world is falling down around us, said Emmy worriedly.
Kate shivered, leaning closer to Emmy for warmth. They'd thought they'd known what it was like being under fire in Greycor, but it had been nothing like this. She was terrified of the house collapsing on them, terrified of being buried alive.
I feel like a mouse in a hole.
They sat there, holding hands in the darkness, listening to the never-ending drone of engines, the rumble of bombs blasting houses to shreds, wondering if they would be alive come the morning.
Do you remember how scared we were when we first got here? Said Kate.
And on the ship,
said Emmy. Do you remember how we thought we were going to be torpedoed?
And that first air raid?
Kate remembered standing out there on the balcony of the hotel, watching the planes, feeling awkward and out of place. She'd never been so scared as she was now, but she didn't feel out of place anymore. These were her people, even Julia.
Maybe, said Emmy bravely. Maybe 6 months from now, we'll be sitting somewhere, saying, remember that time we were bombed in Amiens?
Another tremendous crash shook the walls of the cellar.
You mean while we're being bombed somewhere else? Said Kate shakily. Or maybe we could have some machine gun fire, just for variety.
This war has to end sometime, said Emmy, although she didn't sound quite sure.
This night has to end sometime, said Kate, although she wasn't particularly sure of that either. But it did. At dawn, the last of the planes flew away.
They emerged on shaky legs into a ravaged world of crumbled buildings and people being borne away on stretchers, firemen racing to put out blazes, people mourning their dead.
I don't think we should stay in Amiens, said Nell very seriously. It really isn't healthy.
And that was how Dr. Devine found them, outside the hotel, holding on to each other and snorting with laughter.
Oh, good, your hotel is still standing, he said. I've come to tell you that you're being sent on.
To another safe place? Said Julia sarcastically. Dr. Devine looked rather embarrassed.
We could hardly know. We'll let you know shortly where you're to go.
But first, there were people to help in Amiens. There were refugees at the station who needed to be fed and wounded who needed to be evacuated. Dizzy with fatigue, scarcely knowing what she was doing, Kate handed out blankets and condensed milk. Florence had the bright idea of paying the refugees for their rabbits and hens, since the money would be more use to them than the livestock, and turning the meat into stew on the spot. The next thing they knew, the station was thick with feathers as Florence wrung necks, Emmy plucked, and Anne stewed, while Kate organized people into orderly lines and handed out bowls. She was so tired that everything was starting to blur a bit on the edges. It felt as though she'd always been in this train station, like some sort of purgatory, always heating milk and ladling soup, always helping endless rows of bewildered people onto trains, headed they knew not where. It was the old question and answer. Où allez-vous?
Je ne sais pas.
Except this time, it was the Smith unit who didn't know where they were to go, half dead on their feet, ladling soup in their sleep. Kate couldn't remember the last time she had brushed her hair or changed her clothes.
I feel like one of the hags from Macbeth, she told Emmy as she took over from Anne at one of the big soup pots.
Emmy gave one of her unexpected laughs, bubbling out of her.
Can't you just see us cooking up eye of newt and toe of frog when we run out of chickens?
They're French, said Kate, feeling immeasurably cheered, even if she was beginning to see double.
They eat frogs anyway.
By the time Dr. Devine came to collect them to take them on to wherever they were going, Kate wasn't quite sure what day it was anymore. She was half asleep in the back of the truck, her head on Emmy's shoulder, with Nell asleep in Anne's lap next to her, and Alice asleep on Nell. Julia sat hunched over her medical bag, trying desperately not to yawn, while Florence snored next to her, sleeping like a horse sitting up. She hadn't slept, not really. At least she didn't think she had, but when Kate opened her eyes, the truck had stopped in front of an entirely unknown building on an unknown street. They were in a town, that much was clear. There were tall streetlights and proper sidewalks, but she had no idea what town it was or how far they had traveled.
You can put their bags in here, a familiar voice was saying. We've beds made up for everyone.
Kate blinked at the woman silhouetted in the light from the open door.
Mrs. Barrett?
Welcome to Beauvais, said Mrs. Barrett.
Kate stumbled down out of the truck, and Mrs. Barrett enfolded her in an embrace that smelled like lavender and laundry soap. We've been worried sick about you all. You remember Williams and White and McCoy and McMorris, don't you? And of course, I know you know Miss Shaw. Liza waved at Kate from behind Mrs. Barrett. Kate had no idea what Liza was doing there. And Dr. Clare, who was inconceivably there as well, wearing a violently patterned silk wrapper with her hair braided for bed. Kate began to wonder if she was still asleep and if there were going to be dancing aardvarks next. But where?
We've taken over a girls' school, said Mrs. Barrett. This is our headquarters now, and I'll tell you all about it in the morning once you've had some sleep. My poor girls, what you've been through.
There was something rather wonderful about being fussed over by someone who reminded Kate strangely of her mother, even though Mrs. Barrett looked and sounded nothing like her mother. Maybe it was the way she took charge, bustling them all inside, counting heads, ordering their duffels upstairs to the dormitory, talking all the way. If you can imagine, they actually let us on a train to Grey Corps on Saturday. The wires had been cut by bombs Friday night, so we had no word that the drive had happened. We got as far as Noyon, and then they sent us back to Paris. You can imagine we were frantic to know what had become of you. Everyone has been asking about the unit, and they're all very keen to help. We've been offered everything from motor cars to Victrolas. Mr. White of the White Motor Company called personally to offer a car to us.
That's good, said Kate, her voice rather creaky, because I'm afraid I lost the jitney.
Not to mention all your things. Mrs. Barrett looked sympathetically around the remains of the unit, all of whom were blinking like moles in the light, looking distinctly disheveled and travel-worn next to the new girls. Someone came up to Mrs. Barrett, one of the new girls, White or Williams, Kate didn't remember which. Yes?
We've just had a message from the station master,
said the new girl breathlessly. Her uniform was so clean it made Kate's eyes ache. Or maybe it was just that Kate's eyes were aching already.
There are loads of refugees coming into the station. No one knows what to do with them, and they wanted to know if we could find them something to eat.
Kate looked at Mrs. Barrett, and at Emmy, and Alice, and Nell, and Anne, and Florence, and Julia, all battered and war-worn, all half asleep on their feet.
I could manage to open a few more tins of milk,
Emmy said, rubbing her gritty eyes with the back of her hand.
Me too, said Nell, smothering a yawn,
and Kate felt so full of love and pride for her friends that she thought she might burst with it. Turning to Mrs. Barrett, Kate said, as briskly as she could,
We're ready. What do they need us to do?